The Sinclair headliner, Frank Singizer. Each Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday at this time, the Sinclair Refining Company presents Frank Singizer with his comments on the news, together with the latest headline news from the Associated Press. Here is Mr. Singizer.
Good evening. The news from France tonight is good, better than it has been at any time since D-Day. American troops have captured St. Lô on the western end of the Normandy battlefront, and the British and Canadians have broken through German defenses in the Caen sector directly to the east of St. Lô. The American capture of the big port of Cherbourg was of immediate vital importance because it gave the invasion forces a strategic base from which men and supplies could pour into the expanding beachhead. But today's developments are of great importance because of what they mean in the future. From the capture of St. Lô and the breakthrough southeast of Caen may come the big drive that will carry the Allied armies to Paris and from there on to Germany. Here's why today's victories in Normandy mean so much. The Germans had made a sort of casino out of St. Lô. It was the place where they expected to take the steam out of the American drive. When Cassino finally fell in Italy, you will recall, the Allies swept forward to Rome and far beyond. And now that St. Lô in France has been taken, there's a good chance that the Americans will be able to register their gains from now on in miles rather than in yards. As for the British-Canadian breakthrough southeast of Caen, that is of even greater importance than the capture of St. Lô. By smashing their way across the Orne River in the Caen area, the Allies have broken out into the open. It's almost as though they had battled through a narrow tunnel and then suddenly emerged at the other end. In front of the British and Canadians now are wide open spaces, hundreds of miles of flat lands, ideal for tank warfare. From now on, there will be many large-scale battles between the opposing armored forces. But General Bernard Montgomery has powerful armored units at his command. The dispatches from the correspondents at the front make it plain that the Allies have nothing to fear in the tank struggles that lie ahead. The going has been hard in Normandy. This has been due to a combination of things. Vile weather, strong German resistance, and the fact that the Allies have had no long, wide battlefront on which to operate. The Russians, for example, have had a 1,000-mile front along which to maneuver their forces. They've been able to strike first in one place, then in another, and then in a third. To be accurate, they have struck in 6 places during the past few weeks, keeping the Nazis guessing and preventing them from moving any large forces to any one sector. The Allied front in Normandy, on the other hand, has been less than 100 miles long most of the time. The fighting has been concentrated in 1 or 2 places, so that the Nazis were able to put all their available defensive strength in the path of the Allied advance without fear of some new Allied drive on the same front hundreds of miles away. But tonight the situation may be different. If General Montgomery is able to exploit today's victories in Normandy, the French front soon may widen and lengthen considerably. As it widens and lengthens, the German strategy of defense will have to become more complicated. It was the widening and lengthening of the Soviet front which ruined the German plan of defense in Eastern Europe. The swift pace of the Russian drive appears to have bewildered the Nazi strategists. Each time the Germans get set to defend one of their strongholds, the Russians simply begin another drive 100 or 200 or 500 miles away. For the past week, the Germans have been trying to stem Russian advances toward Latvia and Lithuania and Germany's Prussia. But far to the south, in the lower part of old Poland, the Russians were uncorking another major offensive. And tonight came the announcement from Premier Joseph Stalin that the highly touted German fortifications in front of the city of Lwów in Poland have been broken. It does not seem that the Germans can hold on to Lwów for very long. When it is in Russian hands, the Red Army can drive from Lwów to the northwest, to Warsaw, or it can push directly to the west, to Germany itself. For Lwów is only a little more than 200 miles from the eastern border of Germany. The problems which confront the German high command tonight as a result of these latest Allied advances in France and Russia can be compared only to the perplexities which face the Japanese war leaders. Perplexities which have resulted in 2 major Japanese military changes in the last 2 days. Today it was announced by Tokyo that the Japanese Premier, General Tojo, had been removed from at least one of his posts, that of Chief of the Army General Staff. That is a position similar to the one which General George C. Marshall holds in the United States. Tojo's removal as Army Chief of Staff has started a lot of us wondering whether Tojo has lost his post as Premier and War Minister as well. But so far, there's been no indication from Japan that Tojo still isn't the top man in the Japanese war machine. Yesterday, as you recall, the Japs ousted their Navy Minister, presumably because of the failure of the Japanese Navy to do anything about our capture of Saipan Island in the Marianas. But getting back to the Japanese change in their army setup, the new chief of staff is General Yoshijiri Umezu. It is impossible to say, of course, why the Japanese decided to give the top army post to General Umezu. But here's a bit of background on General Umezu, which we think is particularly interesting because of the importance to all of us of future relations between Japan and Russia. General Umezu has been commander of the Kwantung Army for 5 years. That's the army of at least 500,000 men in Manchuria, which faces the Soviet forces across the Siberian border. In that command, General Umezu has played the leading role in preparing those Japanese armies for the defense of Manchuria against any Soviet attack, or, who knows, preparing them for a Japanese offensive against Siberia. There's no sign that Japan plans any move against Russia right now. The Japanese are too busy in the Pacific. But the appointment of General Umezu, in view of his background, could mean that Japan is worried over what Russia might do when Germany is knocked out of the war. I'll be back in a moment with a look at the latest news on the Democratic Convention front.
Did you know, Mr. Motorist, that you own one of the most valuable pieces of machinery in this country? Yes, it's the motor of your car, the power plant of vital wartime transportation. So don't risk damage to that motor of yours by being careless about lubrication. During these hot summer months, give your motor the protection of Sinclair Pennsylvania or Opaline Motor Oil. These famous Sinclair oils give better protection against excessive wear and breakdowns because they contain no wax or petroleum jelly, those non-lubricating substances that thin out in the heating of driving and dilute your motor oil. So see your Sinclair dealer regularly. Have them drain out the old oil, flush your crankcase and motor clean to get rid of dirt and sludge, and then refill with the correct summer grade of Sinclair Pennsylvania or Opaline Motor Oil. Save wear with Sinclair. And now, back to Frank Singizer.
It's traditional that something unusual always happens at a Democratic National Convention. In the 1944 Democratic National Convention opening tomorrow in Chicago is all set to live up to that tradition. For a time, it looked as though this year's Democratic session would be a cut-and-dried affair, with President Roosevelt and Vice President Wallace being renominated as a matter of course. But all that's changed now. True, Mr. Roosevelt will get the presidential nomination on schedule, that is, on the first ballot. But it's going to take a lot of plugging by Mr. Wallace's supporters between now and Friday to win him the vice presidential nomination. The president's letter to the convention, giving his personal support to Mr. Wallace, hasn't helped the vice president's cause much. In fact, those who oppose the vice president are pointing to that part of Mr. Roosevelt's letter in which he said he didn't want to dictate to the convention as to who the vice presidential candidate should be. And don't think Mr. Wallace doesn't know that he has a fight on his hands. The vice president left Washington tonight for Chicago in an attempt to pull his campaign for renomination out of the fire. He knows that tonight he has more delegates pledged to him than any other prospective candidate. But he also knows that he still hasn't enough to win the nomination on the first ballot. And it is the general belief that each additional ballot taken will weaken rather than strengthen his position. To give you an idea of the kind of battle Mr. Wallace faces, look at what the Pennsylvania delegation did today in a caucus. The delegation took an advisory poll. That is, a poll which does not bind the delegate. 41 Pennsylvania members voted for Mr. Wallace. 21 others either voted against Mr. Wallace or did not vote at all. 10 delegates were absent from the caucus. What makes that vote significant is that the managers of the vice president have claimed right along that Pennsylvania's 72 votes were all for Mr. Wallace. It is one of the peculiarities of the struggle for the vice presidential nomination that the two men who are conceded some chance of upsetting Mr. Wallace's apple cart are men who are close to the president. One is Senate Majority Leader Alvin Barkley, who, with the one exception of the tax bill, has always carried Mr. Roosevelt's banner in the Senate. The other is the Director of War Mobilization, James Byrne, who is a close personal friend of Mr. Roosevelt and who often has been called the Assistant President. Of course, Senator Barkley and Mr. Burns are not openly campaigning as of tonight to win the vice presidential nomination away from Henry Wallace. But as Associated Press correspondent Douglas Cornell pointed out tonight in a dispatch from Chicago, a definite campaign is underway for each man, and you can be sure that neither of them is unaware of the efforts in his behalf. Senator Barkley is in a particularly uncomfortable position, since he is the man who will make the nominating speech for President Roosevelt on Thursday. Meanwhile, there's a rumor in Chicago tonight that the CIO has told Democratic Party leaders that it will not support the ticket if Mr. Burns is nominated as the vice presidential candidate. Mr. Burns is the man who has exercised control over the wage stabilization program, and the CIO has objected to parts of that program. The CIO reportedly is strongly in favor of Mr. Wallace, but is said to be ready to support a compromise candidate as long as that candidate isn't James Byrne. If a compromise candidate should emerge from the scramble, it might be Senator Harry Truman of Missouri, who has won a lot of support for his work as chairman of the Senate War Investigating Committee. The Missouri delegation at a caucus today pledged its 32 votes to Senator Truman. Others who may get a scattering of votes on the first vice presidential ballot are Governor Jay Broughton of North Carolina, Governor Prentice Cooper of Tennessee, Senator Albert Thomas of Utah, and Governor Robert Kerr of Oklahoma. Governor Kerr will make the keynote address at the convention tomorrow night. And if his speech happens to strike a responsive chord among the unpledged delegates, he may win additional support. But in the long run, it appears as though Senator Barkley and James Burns will offer the only real competition to Vice President Wallace. And from this corner, it seems that Mr. Wallace is far out in front, despite the indications that some of his strength is slipping away. It is true that President Roosevelt told the convention that he did not want to tell it whom to elect as the vice presidential candidate. But it is also true that he said that if he were a delegate, he would vote for Mr. Wallace. That will be enough for many of the delegates. And by writing the letter, Mr. Roosevelt has placed the convention in the happy position of being able to say that it selected the vice presidential candidate on its own, whether that candidate be Mr. Wallace or someone else. Now here's some additional late Associated Press news. The Louisiana delegation to the Democratic Convention voted in a caucus tonight to cast its 22 votes for Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia for the presidential nomination. That makes 46 votes pledged to Senator Byrd. But even his strongest supporters admit that the Virginia senator will do little more than cause a ripple in the wave of strength for President Roosevelt. And it was announced tonight at Allied headquarters in New Guinea that four Japanese merchant vessels have been sunk or damaged by Allied planes in the Southwest Pacific. That's tonight's report from your Sinclair headliner. All right, John.
Here's an important message from your government. All types of fuel for home heating will be scarce next winter. That's because the need for coal and oil by the armed forces, as well as by war industries, will increase as we carry the war into enemy-held territory. These needs must be unconditionally met first. So for your own protection, Uncle Sam urges you to do everything you can to prepare your home for cold weather now. First of all, order your next season's supply of fuel right away. Secondly, check up on all heating equipment to ensure peak efficiency of operation. This will help you get the maximum heat from the fuel you will have. And lastly, protect your home against loss of heat by installing insulation, storm doors, storm windows, and weather stripping wherever possible. Don't delay. Prepare for winter now. Sinclair dealers invite you to listen to Frank Singizer Thursday evening at the same time. John Scott speaking. Good night.